Committee would come to order, please. This is the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting. It is Thursday, May 5th, approximately 4:15 in the afternoon. The entire committee membership is here. We have two items up for consideration today. First on the agenda is House Bill 277. And who do we have to present? Representative Kurtulo.
Thank you, Senator Terrio, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee, for hearing this bill so quickly. It's really an honor to be able to present it to you, and I'm just going to be brief because, as any good general would, you know that it's your troops who really matter, and the true force behind this is Senator Elton and Representative Thomas, both of them here today. The family of the two young men that we would like to name the Readiness and UAS Center after are also here today. So if I can quickly introduce them, it's Walter and Clara Spurl, their daughter Marita and her husband Kyle, and also family friends. So with that, I'd like to turn the testimony over to Senator Elton and Representative Thomas. Thank you. I'm staying.
Okay. You want me to go first again?
Yeah. Disbehave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I appreciate the leave of the committee to let me come down here and join Representative Thomas and Representative Kurtulo. My name is Kim Elton. I'm representing Senate District B, which is the city of Juneau. As I introduced myself in the other body, in its committee of referral, I found it odd identifying myself as the representative or the senator from Senate District B because I felt almost compelled to identify myself the way I did 35 and 36 years ago, which was U.S. 50203352. I'm here, I'm not going to recognize the family and friends again of the Spurls and Gambles. I will note that the parents of Charles Gamble Jr. Are elderly and in frail health, and as you can imagine, this is a very emotional time for them also, and they were unable to be here. Charles and Don lived their entire lives here in Juneau. They grew up here, they went to school here. They made plans for the rest of their life here, and when they joined the Army, they joined from Juneau, Alaska. Both were assigned to Vietnam after basic training and training in their MOS. Charles attained the rank of Spec 4. Don attained the rank of Corporal. Charles, who was just a few months younger than I, died October 28, 1969, as a result of a helicopter crash in Vietnam. Don, who was just a few months older than I, died May 8, 1968 from wounds received in the line of duty. The facility that we're attempting to name is a joint-use facility that is shared by the National Guard and the University of Alaska. The National Guard will use a portion of the facility as their armory. The University of Alaska Southeast will use a portion of the facility as a student rec center. This is a very unusual combination. I think it's unique in the United States where an armory and a university are sharing a facility jointly. The facility was built with state, university, and federal dollars and will be completed on the Juneau campus this July. Both the university and the guard have their own naming procedures for buildings that they occupy, and neither really complement the other. The university has broad latitude on picking names. For 3 years, the guard has talked about appointing a naming committee for the new armory, but that hasn't happened. And I have been told by people representing the Guard that they are waiting until the end of the Iraq war before they proceed or wish to proceed with naming the facility. I actually began working with the Guard and with the university on naming this facility, this unique facility, after Don Spurl and Charles Gamble Jr. 3 years ago. I notified the Guard, I notified the university, and I notified the former governor. Was told at that time by the Guard that we will consider your request in the course of the naming committee that was soon at that time to be appointed. I thought this was a unique opportunity. I wrote down my comments this time because when I testified before the previous committee, I started getting a little bit emotional. And so I thought, well, if I work from a recipe of the written word, it might be a little bit easier. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am a fairly frequent visitor to Washington, D.C., but it wasn't until my last visit 4 or 5 years ago that I actually worked up the nerve to go visit the Vietnam War Memorial. I arrived, I did one thing. I opened the registry to find where the names of Charles Gamble Jr. and Don Spurl were, and I went to the appropriate place of the wall. That memorial is thousands of miles away. It's the only memorial that I have seen that has their two names on it. It's in our nation's capital. And I think it's entirely appropriate that their names be attached to something here in the town where they grew up and where they developed their notion of service to neighborhood, to community, to region, to state, and to the nation were developed. I'll just wrap up by saying that I can't think of a better facility to attach the names of these two heroes to. It's a facility that's going to be used by young men and women who are attending the University of Alaska Southeast, members of the community, and it's going to be a facility that is used by other people in our community, in our region, who have dedicated their lives to serving the United States in uniform. Those members of the National Guard that will use the Armory as a training facility. I think it's extremely important to be reminded that in the past, there are people who took the notion of service extremely seriously, and because they did, and because they adopted and used the values that grew in this community, they lost their lives. And so I would encourage the committee to pass out the bill so that we can honor these two young men and so that people in our community can learn from the sacrifice that they made. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Seeing none, go ahead, Representative Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. First off, I want to point out that this is Vietnam Veterans Recognition Week, and it's from May 1st to May 7th, and I thought it was very timely, and that's why I've been pushing it to honor the death of Donald on the, coming up on May 8th, and I think very appropriate. But I met Donnie in 1963, played basketball against him in 63-64. I was a Haynes High Glacier Bear, he was a Juneau Crimson Bear. And those of you who grew up around in Alaska, once you become a basketball player, you're bonded for life. We played 64-65. I graduated from Haynes. He graduated also, that'd be 40 years ago. And I took off, went to University of Alaska, and there he was, and with his cohort, John Lee Kendall. We played basketball up there again with Milo Griffith and Steph Anderson. Bunch of other guys, I can't remember all their names right now. I developed a knee injury, so I quit and came home and got taken care of, and I got drafted in 1966, went through basic training, was going to Vietnam in 68, went to Anchorage from Fort Campbell. Anyway, I was in Japan, and I'm sitting in a bench there with my head down, wondering what the hell is going to happen to me now. I knew nothing about Vietnam. I have to admit, back then it was South Indochina, so I didn't know where I was going. So I'm sitting there, and these two people walk by, and I had looked at them because I've known them for several years then, and it was Donald and John Lee, and they're walking by me, and I recognized their walk. One was about, I haven't said 6'1 or 6'2, and the other was probably 5'9, so it was pretty obvious who they were. So I shoved them, and I said, "What are you guys doing over here?" They had got in the service together, and they were medics, so as I was over there, it was in May, and like any other soldier, you look at the back of the Stars and Stripes to see who got killed, and one day I picked that up, and Donnie was on there. So anyway, I'm here to support the bill. I know the family of Charles Gamble very well, the parents, great people, very proud of their son, as well as Spurls are. And I'm proud to be here and to ask that you put the name on the building. And I know we've had controversy, but I think, you know, that they can always add to it, you know, if in the event, sad event, that something like that may happen. And I pointed out in our committee that if we lose the boy from Haynes, I don't think I'd have his name on the Juno building, that we'd be honored to keep him at home. And I think that, you know, it's been a long time waiting for these two boys to be recognized. And I think it would be a great honor and timely that we do this. And I appreciate the guard's position and the university's. But I think this is a public building. And if you look back at it, there is no place in Alaska that we recognize the Army. There's no place that we can name, I guess. So this is, I think, a very appropriate and very honored if you would move this forward.
Any questions from committee members? Seeing none. Representative Kurtula, did you have any additional comments?
No, the only thing would be that the university is happy to have these names on the building. They're going to possibly name rooms in the future, and the chancellor has said he thought that that would be appropriate. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, can I make one brief addition to my testimony? Just brought with me today, and I think it hopefully was included as a letter in your packet, dated June 19, 2002, from Major General Phil Oates, the Adjutant General of the Guard at the time. And I think with the leave of the chair, I just want to read the middle paragraph that notes, a nominating committee will be formed in the near future, and I will forward your request for consideration. Thank you for your input, and we look forward to supporting the people of Juneau. I think the attitude then was that it was appropriate to recognize Juneau servicemen who died in the line of duty. And I would like to think that that's going to be the net effect with the passage of this bill.
Okay. I have not been tracking this issue, and so the concern that's been raised in the House, I'm sorry, I've not followed that. I was just looking at an email expressing some concern about whether it's appropriate to name it at this time, and I'm just wondering, other than the comments that you've made up to this point, if you have any other comments on the caution that's come in from the representatives of the military, and particularly the National Guard at the state level.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, committee, I read that email too, and my initial response is I didn't like it. I thought it was very morbid that you wait until somebody dies to name the building. And being in the service, you don't sit there and wait. I have a nephew in Iraq right now, and I don't think it's that waiting for him to die to name a building after somebody, I think, is inappropriate. I think we should honor the ones that have already gone and not look forward to somebody else dying in the future. I think I think it's wrong, and you know, we were asked not to bring it up, but since it did, we had to. So I think we go forward, and we can add names on. Heaven forbid that happens for many more boys that come out of Juneau here.
Mr. Chair, I would just add, I mean, we shared between us the email, and we had a discussion about it. Representative Thomas has talked with people on the third floor, and I'm not going to characterize what their comments were, but it wasn't a message that they knew about. The only other thing that I would add, Mr. Chair, is I think it's entirely appropriate that if something tragic happens to another family in Juneau, that we recognize that. I made a commitment when I testified on the House side that if indeed that happens, I'm going to be the first person that will work with the family. If the family's request is to have their name added to the building, that's what I'm going to work for. If the family's request is another kind of memorial, either at that building or someplace else in the community, that's what I'm going to work for. I can tell you that I returned from Vietnam in 1970. It's been 35 years to get to this point where we can recognize young men from Juneau who died 36 and 37 years ago. And I'm not going to let that happen to any other family if, in fact, something tragic happens to their young son or their young daughter in Iraq. I would also just note a concern, and I hope it's a concern that is going to go away in a few months. We don't know how long the dispute in Iraq is going to go. I mean, I think Vietnam, if I'm not mistaken, was our longest war. It went on and on and on. And I would just suggest, I think it's time after 36 or 37 years to recognize two young men who have lost their lives. And for, I don't want to commit the two representatives, but I'd be stunned if we didn't work just as hard to make something happen within 6 months or 8 months or a year for anybody else and any other family that had to go through what the families here have gone through. I also forgot to note, and my colleague from Juneau passed to me a copy of a resolution that should be in your folder also, that is a resolution from the City and Borough of Juneau Assembly in support of naming the building.
Questions from committee members? Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I would like to say thank you to the families that are here today of the two great Americans that we're talking about. And I, too, was in Vietnam. I would ask you, though, to bear with us for just a moment, and let me explain something to you. Once upon a time, I was the Veterans Affairs guy for the state and was involved in some of the naming process of how to get things done, in naming things for people that had made a sacrifice or for some decorated heroism sort of thing. And normally it was a process. It's the first time I've seen the legislature get involved in this sort of thing. I'm not saying it's good or bad, it's just the first time that I've seen it. And I know we named a number of ranges at Fort Richardson, and we sought around the state people to name those ranges after, and some actually Fort Rich, Fort Wainwright, and at Fort Greeley to be able to name it after veterans. And last week, Senator Elton and I had a discussion about this, and I called and talked to the Deputy Commissioner of Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and they explained to me the regulation process. And by virtue of that, I did not know we were hearing this bill today, but just a few moments ago, I talked to Military and Veterans Affairs. General Campbell is going to be here tomorrow to talk to us about this proposition and try to firsthand-wise come to a resolution that works for everybody concerned. And it's not that one's more deserving than the other, or one should defer to the other, but, you know, in all fairness, I mean, to be quite frank, I was also the senior Army advisor to the Alaska National Guard once upon a time, so I know a little bit about how that works. And the facility here is a regional facility. So, I mean, I think we have to keep that in mind, just like, you know, compounds are. And that doesn't mean that it shouldn't be named after the sons that we're talking about here today, but I think it would be fair for the person that is responsible for the naming, that has the authority and the responsibility to do that, the process, to let that person be heard. And he would like to talk to both the representative and the senator here today on that, to try to work out whatever is a good solution. It's not my responsibility. I want to be part of the solution, and I would welcome the opportunity to do that. So, Mr. Chair, my recommendation is that for a minimum of tomorrow, that we defer action on this so that that sort of thing can happen, with General Campbell coming and talking to the proposer and the supporters of this bill.
Mr. Chair, may I ask you that you move it to rules and maybe work our deal out there, and then and have it a little closer to the floor, if we can work something out with the general.
The only problem, Representative, is our Rules Committee does not meet to hear bills or make any possible changes, unlike the House side. So this would be the last committee, other than possible floor action. Do we have any more questions? We do have two people that are signed up to testify, and I'd like to certainly get through all the testimony today and then make a decision where to go from there.
Before I forget, the family did bring the picture for Donald, so I wanted to keep it here. Thank you.
And I'm glad you did. We hear so many times from people on teleconference, and I know Senator Seekins' joke that after a couple months of listening to somebody on teleconference, we like them to send a photo so we can see. And it's always nice to see the person you're talking to or referring to. Senator Elton, you quoted from a letter, and I'm sorry, I don't think I have that in my packet. And so I...
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I'll pass it down, and maybe the committee secretary can copy it for other members. It's a brief three-paragraph letter.
First, why don't we go to Bunny Lindegaard?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the State Senate Affairs Committee. I'm appearing before you today representing the majority of the Juno Douglas High School class of 1965 and the family of Donald Walter Spurl in requesting this referral of House Bill 277 to the Senate. As we celebrate our 40th year class reunion this 4th of July weekend, the class of 65 will fill a big void of the loss of our friend and leader, Donald Spurl. I share with you support that came in the form of an email from classmate Lorraine Hampton Davis. Just wanted to say thank you for this opportunity to express support naming the new facility the Spurl Gamble Armory. What a tribute to the families and those of us who went to Juno Douglas High School with these men. Please feel free to use my name in supporting the name of this facility, the Spurl Gamble Armory. Donald was voted by the entire student body not as the senior most likely to succeed, not as the best athlete, not as the most attractive or the friendliest, but as the best all around. He set high standards for himself and lived them out through his accomplishments in athletics, academics, leadership roles in student government, and civic and spiritual activities in our community. In Vietnam, Donald served as a trained medic serving the small village people where he was located, as well as his fellow soldiers. During previous class reunion meetings and through a recent telephone conversation, classmate Terry Ray, daughter Bill Ray, Shattuck shared, "The best of the best was taken from us, and I concur." But what I ask myself, and I ask you to consider, is what is really in a name? When people, newcomers, and the youth come to this facility to use it, and they look up there and they see Spurl Gamble, and they say, "Who were these men?" They will be told, not only were they two young men who responsibly came to the call of the United States government, but they demonstrated great courage, the epitome of caring by giving us their lives. Their character modeled through their families reflected the very values which unite us in our community and in our nation as a whole: respect, responsibility, integrity, and caring. It is for these reasons that I ask you to consider recommending the approval of House Bill 277 to the Senate. Thank you.
Do we have questions from committee members? Senator Elton.
Just a comment, as a member of the class of 1966, I am stunned at how young Bonnie looks.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Next, Carlos Cadiente?
Carlos Cadiente, and he was going to try and make it, Mr. Oh, he's on telecom.
If you'd go ahead and identify yourself, any affiliation, and give us your comments, please.
My name is Carlos Cadiente. I live in Arc Bay, Alaska. I'm representing myself. I would like to thank the committee for hearing my testimony on House Bill 277. Charles Franklin Gamble, also known as Scoogie, was one of my best friends while growing up in Juneau. He was a full-blood Alaska Native. His parents are Marge and Chuck Gamble. His three sisters are Karen, Marty, and Charlene. Don Spurl is of a longtime Juneau family and grew up on Bain Road. Don was an outstanding varsity athlete. Both Don and Charles were loved by all of their classmates at Juno Douglas High School. Both had the ability to bridge all people in our community together. My father and I debated the Vietnam War often. I believe that war is not the answer. Dad also was devastated when Charles died in Vietnam. I have a picture of my father next to the Vietnam Memorial's panel, 17 West, where Charles' name is. I think it would be a great tribute to both Don and Charles, who made the ultimate sacrifice, to name the new National Guard Army in their honor. Charles' family also approves of the naming of the new National Guard Army after Charles and Don's borough. I also think that naming in honor of Charles and Don would also be a belated thank you to all those who had served in Vietnam from all our Alaskan communities. I have several other Juneau friends and relatives that have served in Vietnam. Naming this army after them would also honor all our Alaska soldiers that are currently in harm's way. I would appreciate your vote in support of House Bill 277. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Elton, on the next bill, I do intend to just recess the meeting and have another meeting tomorrow. So in order to accommodate Mr. Campbell, who's going to come in, I'd like to hold it over. As I've explained, we don't have rules committees, so there wouldn't be the opportunity for rules to have any further testimony. And just a quick question. Marty Whitney, is it that Charles's sister?
Thanks for remembering, Mr. Chair. Marty Whitney is Charles' sister. I first met Marty when I worked in former Lieutenant Governor Terry Miller's office. Have been a friend of Marty's for a long time. I've got to tell you that I didn't know until several years ago that Marty was Charles' sister. If I had, I mean, the relationship that I had with Marty was very warm and very. I consider her a good friend. And it would have added another level if I had known when I first met her, because it was something else that we shared. She, of course, shared it in a much more tragic way. But yes, Marty is the sister. And Mr. Chair, I understand the desire of the member from Wasilla, from the Mat-Su. And I think that's good, but I think it would be appropriate, if possible, that he not just meet with some politicians who are talking about this as a concept, but that while he's in town, he try to meet with members of the family so that it is not just a concept, it's a reality for him also.
Sure. I worked with Marty for 9 years in this building, so. Okay, we will set 277 aside then until tomorrow, and we will take it up again at that time. At this time, I'm not sure. Heather, do you know schedule-wise tomorrow, what time we might be shooting?
Take a spaghetti.
We will work with everybody's schedules and try to do something in the afternoon so there's time in the morning for conversations to be had. And so with that, we'll take a brief.
Mr. Chair, before the at ease, I was handed a note by my staff person that I have a meeting with General Campbell tomorrow morning at 8:45, and I don't think he would mind, while the family is here, if the family wanted to talk about sending a representative or several representatives to the meeting at 8:45. I think that would be very appropriate. I hope it wouldn't bother the general.
Let's take a brief at ease. Committee, come back to order. Next item up, and what I'd like to do is have an introduction of the CS on House Bill 94 today, and then we will bring that back up tomorrow. I would like to have Joe Balash from my staff come forward to, or let's see, should we have Division of Elections come up first?
Yeah.
But why don't you give us the overview, and then Joe will be able to talk to some of the changes.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Laura Glazer, Director, Division of Elections.
Before you go any further, could we get a motion on the R version, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Committee Substitute House Bill number 94, version R, be moved for consideration.
Bring it before us as a working document without objection. Then your comments will be to the R version.
Mr. Chairman, I can speak to the R version in general terms. We can talk about the committee heard the companion bill, Senate Bill 76, in early February. We were waiting for the House bill to go through. There have been many changes since the overview we talked about with Senate Bill 76. We discussed, I believe at that time, the ability of a person with power of attorney to register on behalf of a voter and to apply for an absentee ballot. Those things are in House Bill 94. Do you want me to just talk to the changes in R, or
actually,
because you say
since it's been some time, it's been some time since we had that.
And I'll
overview.
Go through the general, and then we'll go through the changes. All right. This sectional highlights that's included in your packet is probably one of the easiest things to follow. The sectional analysis goes through and explains where each committee made changes. But this is in really simple terms: which sections are affected, and what's the meat of each of those sections. So we allow for power of attorney. We allow voter registration forms to be accepted by scanning. We already do that by fax. That a voter's record is presumptive evidence of a voter's residence. Current law says that a voter card is presumptive evidence. Obviously, there can be a mistake. You can be carrying an old card. It's your record. Only a voter or a power of attorney or a person with power of attorney may mark a party affiliation on a voter registration form unless the voter already registered in that party. That change was made on the House floor. We include the definition of nonpartisan and undeclared voters. It's the definition that standard use that you'll find on your voter registration card, and yet it's not set out in law. The voter list protects confidentiality of voters. There were changes in Senate Bill 284 last year, and this is just adding to a section of the current law, and defines re-registration for voters who have been inactivated. Great change in how state affairs occurred on precinct boundary and polling place changes, which now requires letters to affected voters, publishing one notice in a local paper, posting if there's no local paper, posting on the division's website, notice to clerks, native groups, and community councils. You'll see in the current law that letters are required to affected voters. It's not required to publish for polling place changes currently, and we have to publish three times for boundary changes. So there was some compromise there to make the notice requirements like for those types of situations. Ballots and envelopes, a big change in House State Affairs now requires the division to do ballot rotation for all candidates except for those for State House. So we currently do a random draw of the names, of the alphabet, and that's how the ballots are posted, and now there'll be ballot rotation within the House districts. Election workers must now record ballots destroyed or returned for destruction. That was recommended by the division, and it's to ensure ballot accountability. Also added in House Judiciary, hand count verification of one precinct, 5% of the votes cast per district by the State Review Board prior to election certification. That's not current practice of the division. There now must be a voter certificate on a ballot envelope regarding false statements that are punishable by law. That occurred because in House State Affairs, they reduced the witness requirements. They don't have to be a U.S. citizen to witness, and only one witness is required now on absentee by mail. So House Judiciary felt that there needed to be some attention to the fact that false statements are punishable by law. And if a voter fails to mark the choice of a primary ballot, the division will send the ballot according to affiliation. What you'll see in version R is the language that, and this was added on the House floor. And on the House floor, we added the language, if unaffiliated, a voter will get the ballot with the greatest range of candidates. That's been removed in version R because, in conferring with the Department of Law, our current law on the primary doesn't offer a primary ballot with the greatest range of candidates from the greatest many parties. That was a court order in the 2004 election, but our current law, we don't have an open primary ballot, so we therefore can't offer that to someone when it's not required by law. So in version R, you'll see that section's been removed. That was added on the House floor. Last year, 2004, of course, this bill, its genesis was in 2003, and we had tried to deal with independent candidates for president and vice president, anticipating the Ralph Nader candidacy. We did not have laws in place, and yet we did try and work with the laws that we have. What you see in House Bill 94 are our new laws dealing with independent candidates for president and vice president, that the names on the ballot shall be posted the same as party candidates. The process for qualifying as an independent candidate is now addressed in House Bill 94. The votes for electors and the duties of electors for an independent candidate for president or vice president is now the same as those for party candidates. Also in version R, early voting. Originally, the division had suggested that the sites were to be designated by the director of January 1st of an election year. We've been having a continuing discussion, and it was brought to my attention that perhaps June 1st might be a better date to set as the boundary to make a decision, because in an election year, those requests for early voting sites were coming. We actually were getting them in September and October to try and get as close to an election and yet allow the division to have proper time to order supplies, get election workers trained, and set up an early voting site. So version R accommodates that request to push it back to June 1st. And the division asks for you to accept that change. In absentee voting, as I mentioned earlier, we reduced the witnesses required for submitting a by-fax ballot from two witnesses to one, and they're no longer required to be U.S. citizens. You also may apply for an absentee ballot by scanning an application. Power of attorney may also apply for an absentee ballot on behalf of the voter. And only a voter or person with power of attorney may mark the affiliation unless the voter already registered in that party. That was a change made on the House floor. Only a voter or power of attorney may mark the choice of a primary ballot, also added on the House floor. Reducing the witness required for submitting a by-mail ballot, also to one witness and not a U.S. citizen. Voter to certify under penalty of perjury that the statements are true. That was added in House Judiciary, again, for the concern that you're reducing the witnessing requirement, but we want people to understand that witnessing a ballot is an important thing, and that was discussed in House Judiciary. And the definition of an overseas voter is now the same as AS 1505011. Current law says addresses military APO and FPO addresses, and that's not sufficient to include all as overseas voters. For recounts, the deposit amounts were raised. And the current amounts that are currently in law had not been raised since 1986, so they addressed that in House Judiciary as well. By mail voting, the division will not mail ballots to addresses previously recorded as undeliverable. There was some concern about that. This is only for total by mail elections that the division, it's a whole section of law, that's REA and CRSA elections, and there's no application back and forth between the voter. The voter just automatically sent the ballot. That's why the concern is that if you know that there's an undeliverable address, you wouldn't just send a ballot to a community not knowing that it could be delivered. Voting system requirements, the divisions to use only those machines and systems approved by the FEC. There are no current standards required in law. Added in House State Affairs were sections 24, 26, and 27. At the time of filing, a candidate will need to meet the constitutional age requirements on the first day of session. It's not addressed in state law now, but they believed that was the intent, and they added those sections in House State Affairs. Perhaps the greatest bulk of the bill for us are those sections to improve initiative referendum and recall. These areas started to change throughout the process. An application is to include the printed name, signature, address, and numerical identifier of sponsors. Current law only requires signatures. The request for from the division is to have as much information as we can to qualify those voters who have signed initiative and a referendum or recall petition, and having an ADL, an ID number, a date of birth, something else to check would help us verify that voter's signature. Language that says that the sponsors support the action. It's kind of given, but it's restated in law now. The printed name, numerical identifier, and date when the petition is signed. There's been some question raised with the CTAX petition as to whether when a voter has signed a petition, were they a qualified voter. If there's a date on a petition book at the time, that question can be answered. If you sign the petition on, say, for instance, May 5th, 2005, when the division pulls it up, are you a registered voter on May 5th, 2005? Again, that was to help ensure that the voters who signed would indeed be counted as being qualified signature.
Senator Elton.
Is it appropriate
go ahead.
To interrupt Laura? I want to make sure I understand. But what happens in the case when a petition book is dated May 15th? The person might sign it in June, right, and become a qualified voter on June 1st?
Senator Elton, through the chair, no, and I'm sorry that I don't have a copy of a sheet to show you what a petition booklet sheet says. What this requires, what the section of law requires, would be that when you sign the petition booklet, you date the day that you signed it. So it's not related to the petition book, when it was issued, when it was dated, when the circulator first picked it up. It's only to help justify the fact that that voter was indeed registered to vote the day they signed it. It has nothing to do with the circulation of the petition or anything else. It's to ensure that the voter was registered at the time. Also, language that booklets are to be sequentially numbered. That's the current practice, but again, needed to be stated in law. Petition to include the cost of implementing a proposed law or conducting a recall election. That was added in House Judiciary. It's like adding a fiscal note with an initiative now or a recall effort. In a recall effort, how much would it cost to put on a special election? But we're required to say how much it would cost to put an initiative on the ballot. And it does not include the legal costs. Representative Guerra had some concerns. He didn't want, you know, if there are a legal battle between the administration, say, and the carrier of the petition, those legal costs are not included in the estimate of the cost to prepare the petition. Only the basics. That the qualifications of a circulator must be a citizen at least 18 years old and Alaska resident. It's been in practice, but the law was not changed appropriately after the Buckley ruling. Again, that the printed name and numerical identifier and date when signed are required when withdrawing their name from a petition. Again, just for verification purposes. I'm trying to pick the most important parts. The definition of a numerical identifier is before you as the voter's date of birth, an Alaska driver's license or ID number, the last four digits of the Social Security number, or a voter ID number. Again, all of those options available to the voter when they sign any one of those, and that it's just a check point for the division. I don't remember which section got removed, but sections 56 and 57 deal with recognized political parties.
Go ahead.
This is a function of my age, Laura. I
apologize, but did you say that a section had been removed?
In version R.
In version R. And that's a section that was removed did what?
I'm trying to make sure I tell you which one, which section was removed correctly. Would be on, in this highlights, was then Bill Section 57, which defined a political party as 2% of the total votes cast for governor at the preceding election, or 2% of the total votes for U.S. Senate, or 2% of the total votes for U.S. Representative at the most recent general election or when a governor was elected, or 2% of the registered voters. So by removal, we would go back to the current law, which was changed in, I believe, House Bill 414, went to a conference committee. That's the current definition of a political party. So by removing it from House Bill 94, we would go back to the current law.
And that was passed just last year?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. But what remains in the version before you is the process for a political group to become a party and ensures that a party cannot lose its status during an election cycle and explains the verification process. It's something that the division has tried to do but it's not set out in law and really isn't fair to the parties without it being set out in law, and that is included in what's now Section 59 of the bill before you.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
On the section that was removed, I want to make sure that I understand. So it's been removed from version R. The House passed it at 2%. Version R kicks it back to the current law of 3%.
Senator Elton, through the chair, that's correct.
But it's the difference between 2% of the total registered versus 3%, and we had sort of a cascading standard that was passed in the bill last year.
If I could, Mr. Chair, I'd be interested so that I can see what the effect would be. I mean, can you tell me that, you know, under the bill as it passed the House, what parties would be qualified versus the new version R, and what parties might drop out if, in fact, we revert to the 3% standard?
Senator Elton, through the chair, I'm sorry, because there's one last level. I could tell you that between 3 and 2%, let's do it this way. Between what passed the House and what is current law, the same parties that would have qualified as far as how their candidates achieved either 3 or 2% would be the same. No one would have been added if we went to 2%. No one party or group would be added. The difference, however, is in current law, it's 3% of the total votes cast, which is a lower number than 2% of the total registered voters. So what I can't tell you is, by actually going back to the current law, in that manner do we pick up additional. I'm sorry, I didn't even think to do the math on that before today, and if your intent is to hold it, I promise I would get that for you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. As I read this, I do see that under the proposed or the prior to the R version, it says it has 2% of the total votes cast for governor or U.S. Senate or U.S. representative, or 2% of the number of registered voters, and that is kind of a complicated. Well, it seems to be the same recipe used in current law, except current law has 3% instead of 2%. Am I misreading that the recipe is the same? The only difference is the percentage.
Senator Elton, through the chair. No, they are different. The recipe did change, because when you read current law, it says that nominated a candidate for governor who received at least 3% cast for governor at the preceding general election or as registered voters number in the state to at least 3%. If the office of governor was not on the ballot at the preceding general election, but the office of senator was on the ballot, then the Senate becomes the key. What's in the House version, what's in the version that passed the House, let you qualify in several different areas, either governor, either senator, or representative in the same election cycle. This current law sets an either or. It's this, and if a governor isn't on the ballot, then you look at the U.S. Senate, and if there is no U.S. Senate, then you look at the U.S. House. So it's a, as the chairman said, it's cascading, whereas you might say in the House version, the options were there for qualification.
Well, and plus the or 2% of the number of registered voters, which is not, well, let's see, 3% of registered.
Should get that copied.
Numbers. So in the current law, there's no category that's just percentage of those registered. It's all contingent on votes that have been cast. And of course, now with the fact that we can't purge the voter rolls like we used to periodically, it's much more difficult. It's the actual elections that sort of give you a snapshot on, well, who's still here in the state, because we do have quite the transitory population. So it seems, strikes me as being more valid to instead of a percentage of a role that may be ratcheting up, but with a lot of people that have moved on, to keep it to votes that have been cast. And because of the cascading, you go with the name on the ballot or the race on the ballot that's likely to generate the most participation from your voters, too.
Mr. Chair, I think I understand. It would be very helpful to me if I could, if there could be some kind of a chart or something that gives the marginal parties and whether they qualify under the recipe approved by the House and whether or not they qualify under the recipe proposed in this committee substitute. That helps put things in perspective for me.
And Mr. Chairman, I did prepare something for House State Affairs that's not quite that comparison level, but to talk in general terms, to just rattle off some numbers. The number of registered voters on general election day in 2004 was 472,160. 3% of those who voted for U.S. Senate was 9,329, and the only parties that would have qualified under that marker would be the Republicans and the Democrats. 3% of those who voted for U.S. Representative that nominated a candidate receiving 3%, that number is 9,298, and the Republican Party, the Democrat Party, and the Green Party would have qualified if it had been a U.S. representative, if that had been the banner year. But 2% of those who registered to vote, oh, this was done at a time when they had a date certain, was 8,977. Of course, that number is always going to be greater if the mark is registered to vote. As the chairman was explaining, we don't have 100% turnout. So 3% of your turnout is going to be smaller than 2% of those registered to vote, or very, very close. But I'd be happy to get those numbers together for the committee.
It would also be helpful to put it in perspective. What, I mean, I don't know if there's a standard percent that other states have, but it would be nice to know what the range of percentages in other states might be.
Senator Elton, through the chair, I have a document from last year that does show that. Also, if the committee's interested, the state has been in litigation on this issue, and the Supreme Court did find that our 3% rule was sufficient. That's been very recent, within the last month. I could provide a copy of that as well, if that would help.
In fact, the legislation last year was based around, was it a lower court's decision that has just now been affirmed by the Supreme Court? Because I remember talking about the court interaction when we debated the bill last year. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure about that, but I do know that that those numbers, the 3%, was upheld.
Other questions, Senator?
No. And then just finally, at the very end of the bill, regarding incorporation elections, DCD asked us last year to include changes that define a qualified voter as a person registered to vote within the proposed municipality or borough for at least 30 days before an election. The current law says a qualified voter is defined as being a resident of the municipality or borough, and that's almost impossible for them to determine. So they ask that it be a registered voter, and then they define qualified voter as one who has the qualifications under 1560.010. And that's pretty much a summary of the Division of Elections changes that were incorporated into.
Okay, and then if the members will look on page 7, line 20, it starts with an 11 and then says an attestation. The House had the word oath. You have, the Attorney General's office has a problem with that and has asked us to go back to this attestation. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm sorry that I left that out. Back when it was House Bill 523, Representative Gruenberg changed the word oath, changed the word attestation to oath, saying that oath was outdated. However, when we did research on the National Voter Registration Act and our compliance with that as a state, we can't require an oath. An attestation is the proper phrase. So we work with the committee and would ask that we change that back to attestation and let it stand as it does in current law. Then I think that you're right that we got the June 1st change for us.
The June 1st change is on page 13, line 20. And Laura, what's your reasoning there again?
Mr. Chairman, we had suggested January 1st. To be honest, we picked a day that we thought was reasonable. As we started discussing with groups, people that would be interested in early voting, we did have requests on military bases to do early voting sites, that we wanted to set a date that was reasonable, close enough to an election so that people are actually thinking in an election year. If it were January 1st of an election year, would in December of 2005, would you be thinking that I would like an early voting site at this location? Perhaps not. June 1st is a reasonable date that we can still organize election worker efforts, have supplies, and more importantly, June 1st, we can't order our ballot printing prior to June 1st, obviously, because that's the last day to file as a candidate. So then we can order sufficient ballots to provide for an early voting site.
Questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you. Now, Joe, if you would go over the other changes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Balash. The changes I'd like to speak to occur on pages 9, 10, and 11, and they are encompassed by sections 11, 12, and 13. These changes are coming about or being proposed as some of the observations made in the last election at the federal level as well as the state level, and that has to do with the activities of 527s. 527s are a creation of federal law. They are not required to disclose where they get their money, and they engage in voter registration and voter turnout efforts. Parties don't have that advantage. Every dollar they raise has to be from private sources, and they may not use corporate money or union money or any other money other than from a private individual. However, we didn't want to go back to the bad old days of soft money going to parties and being dumped into campaign ads. And so what we've done here is, if we go to the last section, section 13, defined party building to mean the activities of a political party to register voters, organize precincts, districts, and regions, and otherwise engage in activities that build, maintain, or strengthen a political party in this state, but does not include an express communication or an electioneering communication. Both of those terms have been defined by the legislature over the last 4 years, and have really strengthened the way APOC looks at the content of an ad and determines whether or not only hard dollars can be used for those ads. And so by defining party building in a negative way in the context of an electioneering communication or an express communication, that exception for party building can be allowed in the 610 days after an election, but not in the next 120 days, which are the 120 days before the next election. And if I may, the federal law that is in place, which preempts state law, requires that any activity by a party be done with hard dollars, and that be the 120 days before the general election. It's 60 days before the general and 60 days before the primary, and in Alaska that neatly works out to approximately the 120 days before the general election. So that means every dollar spent by a state party in Alaska must be done with hard dollars in the 120 days before the general election. So backing up then to Section 11, we have the definition of contribution, and then in Section 12, the definition of an expenditure. And those make allowances for party building functions, but again, due to the way we've defined party building, that money would not be able to be used to influence the outcome of an election.
And could you go over that list again of, you said, setting up your precinct,
sure,
operations, things of that nature?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. The definition as it reads, the activities of a political party to register voters, organize precincts, districts, and regions, and otherwise engage in activities that build, maintain, or strengthen a political party in this state. And in this context, we're talking about a voter registration drive, a door-to-door effort to try and register people who are newly arrived to an area, organizing that local precinct or district, putting on a party picnic or rally or convention, so long as it does not occur in that 120-day period before the election. And so this really would have an impact primarily in the non-election years, and also to a limited extent in the election year. And but so far out from the time when voters are starting to even begin to engage, that this really ought not to have an impact on the voters and the campaign themselves.
Okay. Do committee members have questions? Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And Joe, if you don't know the answer, I'm trying to put this in some perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is party building? Would party building include making phone calls, asking people to identify whether they're leaning for one candidate or another, so that the party can at some other time get back in touch or pass on to their candidates people that may be leaning their way? Is that considered party building if it occurs prior to 120 days before a general election?
The chairman, Senator Elton, I believe that sort of activity would qualify as party building. However, as I think about the definition of an express communication, which is unfortunately not here, but an express communication has been defined consistent with some Ninth Circuit case law, and the name is just slipping from my mind at the present, but the communication, when read as a whole and with limited reference to outside events or context, can be determined to be nothing other than an exhortation to vote for or against a candidate. And so I don't believe, and that express communication standard exists every day, every year, election year or not. So so long as the activity didn't fall under an express communication definition into the express communication world, if you will, then no, it would not be proscribed in the period before 120 days before the election, if I wasn't completely circular and confusing.
I think you did a good job. Thanks, Joe. And a follow-up question.
Just quick, was that the Buckley?
No, Mr. Chairman, Buckley was the Bright Lines.
Senator, do you have a follow-up question?
A follow-up question, just a note. I'm always impressed when the Ninth...
With what?
I'm always impressed with the decisions by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
It's the most overturned court in the land, Mr. Chairman.
I couldn't resist saying that. Mr. Chair, I'll be serious now and ask a follow-up question. Some of the most offensive kinds of communications are often those communications that say, did you know that X did Y? And I mean, off the top of my head, that happened to Senator John McCain fairly frequently. I mean, that would not necessarily be an express communication because it didn't encourage a vote. So that could be considered, that kind of a communication could be considered party building?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, through the chair, Senator Elton, in Alaska, no. That would fall under the definition of an electioneering communication.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Which was new law passed 4 years ago, I think?
If I recall correctly, 2001, either 2001 or 2002.
Any further questions? Seeing none, we do have a few people to get to on the teleconference. First of all, let's go to Jim Sykes. Mr. Sykes, are you there?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Would you go ahead with your comments, please?
Sure. Hopefully, I sent some written comments in, which I hope all of you in the committee have gotten a copy of. And I did not have the benefit of seeing version R, so what I referred to in my comments was actually what passed the House. That was the latest version I had access to online, which would have been the CS for House Bill 94 Finance as amended. And it spoke to Section 57, which I believe you're contemplating removing. In general, I feel the elections bill is a good one as passed the House. I've worked on a number of these issues for most of the past 10 years with many directors of the Division of Elections. What I would like to speak to is what Elections Director Glazer just mentioned, is the business about the vote test. And I incorrectly stated something on line 5, paragraph 2 of my written remarks. I stated the current bill, referring to the House Pass bill, has a registration test roughly 4 times as great as the vote test. That was not correct. It is twice as great as the vote test, but it is about 4 times as great as what other states with similar requirements generally have. And that's what I have submitted to you as evidence. I am not aware of any state that has a higher registration test than a ballot test. There may be one, but I don't know where it is. At the most, there is an equal registration test with a vote test, but the vote test is much smaller than what Alaska is requiring. So I would encourage you to restore the section which was 57, 1560.010.23 subparagraphs A, B, C, and D. And what I would request is an amendment to make the D option, in other words, the alternate avenue to recognition of a political party as one half of 1%. Now, I'm the sort of special elections advisor to the Green Party, and I know all of you on the committee are Republicans and Democrats, and I know that you have the responsibility of making sure that we develop good public policy for not only all political parties, but those who are not registered to any political party, the 51% of Alaskans in that case. To give you an idea of what a 2% registration requirement would be, there are only two political parties that I'm aware of that have a 2% registration in all of the United States, other than Republican and Democrat, and that would be the Alaska Independence Party in Alaska, and they didn't achieve that until Governor Hickel and John Coghill Sr. were elected in 1990, and the other was the California Constitution Party, which I believe was actually the result of a merger of political parties. So in the United States, requiring 2% registration is an extremely high requirement, and our law only requires a modicum of support or a small showing. And in pages 2 and the last brief page of my written remarks, I cite Vogler, which is the guiding law for saying how restrictive it should be. And I'll leave to you to consider those. The other evidence I hope that I get across to you is that the registration tests, they could have registration tests and ballot tests, have a far, far less requirement for registration than ballot tests. And I've averaged them all out that are similar, and it comes to about one half of 1%. So that's the amendment I would recommend to you. In relation to the remarks that were made of history, until 1996, there was no avenue for political parties to acquire recognition through registrations until 1996. And at that time, it was established as 3% of the votes in the governor's race. In terms of litigation and decisions from the Supreme Court regarding ballot status, there have been a couple of things that have happened. There was a Supreme Court case that was just written. It was actually just the written opinion of a party that did not have ballot status and tried to get on the ballot in 2004. And the Green Party, which most directly challenged the 3% requirement, has not yet been heard by the Supreme Court. What did happen in the Superior Court was a preliminary injunction was issued saying that 3% in the governor's race, the Green Party actually has always gotten 3% in some statewide race, but we didn't get it in the governor's race. And I think 2002, the Division of Elections moved to decertify us. We said that we got 6-7% in the U.S. Senate and U.S. House race. And the judge said, well, basically, the Green Party has showed a modicum of support, even though they didn't get the 3% of the governor's race, which was the law at the time. And this very well may prevail, and the House version of the bill dealt with that specific requirement. It made any statewide race at the level of 2%, which makes sense. I would urge you to reject going back to the current law, which said you had to get 3% in the governor's race only if there is a governor's race, 3% in the U.S. Senate if there is no governor's race and there is a U.S. Senate race, and only in the case if there is no governor's race or no U.S. Senate race, you can qualify by getting 3% in the U.S. House race. I think that the feeling was, the idea was to get the most, the highest vote-getting race in order to get recognition. However, if you would choose any of these races and say, this is the one that gets highest recognition, it would be incorrect. For example, if you take the 2002 governor's race, it was the most highly voted race of all the statewide races. But if you take the 1998 governor's race, for example, the governor's race was the least voted in all three of the statewide races. And so I think when you're only looking for a modicum of support to have a political party just say to show that they've got some support, that any statewide race ought to qualify, and that's what the House race did. In terms of the the avenue to get at voter registration. If you would like to go along with what the percentage is, I would urge you to consider that it should be the same as a nominating petition. And Vogler spoke to this small amount of support. Now, political parties have more rights and responsibilities than somebody who gets on the ballot by a nominating petition. However, the difficulty of registering people to the political party is far more difficult than trying to get people to sign the nominating petition. The other item I would mention to you is that smaller political parties have an additional hurdle due to the fact that the primary election race has changed almost every time since 1996 for one reason or another. And at the present time, independent voters, or nonpartisan voters more accurately, actually have more rights to choose what ballot they get than anybody who is registered to a political party. And whereas there is a new national high in registration and independent voters because there is dissatisfaction with the major parties, it adds an additional burden in Alaska where the law has changed and people want to preserve their maximum options since they were still used to voting on an open blanket primary prior to 1996. So I hope that I have made it understandable to you that registering voters to a political party is an extremely difficult test to meet. And if you have any questions about the court cases or where we sit, in all the work that I've tried to do in all these election bills, I've tried to make something that is fair to all political parties and those who are not registered to a political party. I've tried to make sure that what is done is straightforward, easy to understand, and good public policy, regardless of where your political leanings may be. And so I would urge you to reconsider what the House bill did in Section 23, A, B, and C with the proposed amendments that I brought by you for 4D. And if you want to cast that in terms of a percentage of a statewide race, I would urge you to just simply select the governor's race, which is the same existing requirement for a nominating petition. And I apologize for taking a lot of your time. I know that you are very busy, but I just wanted to address some of these things that people brought up because I know that these details are sometimes hard to understand, and I hope I clarified them instead of confusing them. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. If you have any questions, I'll try and answer them to the best of my ability.
Thank you. Do we have questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Sykes. We'll come here, Amy Page. And then, Joe, would you just see if Mr. Sonneman is still, is he outside? Or?
My name's Amy Page. I live at 592 Cedar Street in Juneau. And I wanted to thank the committee and the legislature for dealing with the election issues. I think they're very important to pick up correct some of the difficulties. I think basically Alaska has had a very good election procedures. I was involved with the recount, and I was an observer and was really impressed with how the Division of Elections managed the recount. And I think that the bill you got from the House is pretty good, and I would encourage you to move it on to the floor and pass it. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Page, are you here just representing yourself? Or you?
Yes, myself.
Mm-hmm. Any questions? Seeing none. Annette, are you just monitoring the bill, or did you have to? Okay. Okay, well, is there anybody else here to testify, or is there anybody else online? Hearing none, we will hold this bill over. At this time, I'm going to just recess to the call of the chair. Heather, we don't have any other bills so we will try and work with everybody's schedule to get something set for tomorrow afternoon. That will leave tomorrow morning for some discussions to take place on both bills that are before us. It would be my intent to have them both back up before the committee tomorrow afternoon. So with that, we will recess to the call of the chair. Thank you.